Okay, it's 7 o'clock. It's the first day of DEF CON. Everybody wants to go out and get blitzed, so we're going to try to keep this fast and sweet. All right, sweet. Well, throw them back if you got them. My name is Joshua Wright. I'm going to be emceeing this fun little panel that we're going to be doing. Now, when we started this, we were talking about doing a panel presentation, basically because not a single one of us was ambitious enough to get off our asses and actually get something done. So we thought we'd just be able to stand up here and talk to you guys and not really have anything to present other than what we have in our heads. Fortunately, what happened was, in the past couple of weeks, we've all gotten a tremendous amount of work done. We're going to show you some stuff that's as near zero day as it gets. We're going to show you some attack tools that are just gonna blow you away. So you'll have to let us know what you want. So the panel is called Abusing 802.11, Weaknesses in Wireless LANs. And we're calling this DEF CON for Attendees with ADD. Show of hands, please. How many people have ADD? What was I doing? What was I saying? Right. Sorry. What? Okay. Mike? Just press space once, Mike. Okay. This is going to be quick. Like I said, we're cramming 4 hours of material to 60 minutes. So we're going to get through a lot of material. We're not going to have a lot of time for questions. That's a downside of doing all this fun stuff. Each speaker is going to try to answer a couple of questions. We've got a tight schedule that we're going to try to keep to. Please, if you have questions, write them down, you know, put them on your hand, whatever. This is the last session, so we'll have time to be able to answer questions afterwards, and hopefully have some time at the end of the session, and hopefully everybody will still be sober enough to remember what they were thinking about. Okay, Mike. Okay, so our itinerary. First, we're going to have Dragorn's going to be talking about the release of Kismet 3.0 that just went up on the website yesterday, which is a very huge release. I'm going to be talking about an attack against Cisco Leap Networks, and I'm going to be demonstrating a tool for that. Anton Rager is going to be demonstrating a attack tool that I'll let him go over that blazes some flaws in web. Abaddon's going to be talking about AirJack 2, which is a very exciting thing that he's been working very hard on for all of us. We're all very excited about that. And then at the end, we're going to have an opportunity to be able to talk about, answer your questions, talk about things in the wireless security field. It doesn't have to be just things that are in the panel.
Does it work better? Okay, it's really quiet and feedbacky. Yay. Okay, Kismet 3's out. Lots of new toys in it. It's been about 6 months since the last release. Any better? Any better now? Okay. Kismet 3's out. Lots of new toys in it. It's been about 6 months since the last release. This one should be more stable. Just cover the main new things that are out in it. The channel hopper is now part of it. I got a lot of questions about people who had to start it separately, who didn't, so that's taken care of. Packet handling's a little more secure. It spawns off multiple processes to handle each capture source, does IPC back to the non-root dissector. Some of the big things in it, there's some stateful packet inspection now. It'll detect, yes, thank you, probe not join. It will detect things based on behavior instead of single packet signatures. So things like NetStumbler will get detected with how they behave looking for networks and never participating in them. Remote sniffer drones. You can now run a capture source on a cheap throwaway PC, send the packets over a wired network, and analyze them with one Kismet server. It works in OS X now. There's new alert systems, and there's more drivers. I see we have OS X fans. There's some more detailed things here. With the Kismet drones, you can cover the entire floor of a building or an entire building, send all the packets over the wired network, log them all in one place, pipe them all to snort in one place. basically, if you're too cheap to buy his company's product. it's a good thing for, it's not so much oriented towards war driving, but it's good for IDS. The new alert system, previously all the alerts came in pretty much unmanaged. You can now do burst alerts, rate limiting. Eventually we'll have plugins. I've been saying that for a year. It'll happen when it happens. I mentioned the stateful packet alert stuff already, and the named pipe output allows you to use a named pipe file, which IDSs like Snort can then open and do live layer 3 IDS of the packet stream. And if you put the web keys into Kismet, it will deweb the packets for Snort, which is fairly important if you're doing IDS. And that actually looks pretty much the same as it did before, so. We weren't going to do this with a live capture stream, but we end up having to, so should be interesting.
It's built in. Just run Kismet.
Can we dim the lights? No? Okay. No one yet. Actually, it really looks pretty much the same as the previous versions. I mean, people can go through the screens themselves. So we'll move on to people with more interesting tools now.
It's my turn, I guess.
Put it back on one.
Back on one? Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Okay. We're on schedule. I'm the schedule Nazi. Okay. As long as I've known Mike Kershaw, he's never taken enough credit for Kismet. It's a great product. It's a great tool that he could get a lot of money for. Mike Kershaw.
Thanks.
Okay. I'm going to be spending a couple minutes talking about weakness in the LEAP challenge response mechanism. Okay. What is LEAP? Well, LEAP is Cisco market share. What's the deal? So LEAP is Cisco's plan on controlling the 802.11 airspace. Now, we've got different EAP types available to us for 802.1x authentication on wireless networks like PEEP, TTLS, EAP-TLS, but none of those three make Cisco as much money as LEAP does. So what's the deal with LEAP? It's the lightweight extensible authentication protocol. It's also known as Cisco EAP. It's easy to install and configure, easy to support with a unified supplicant, and it must be secure, right? Well, the thing about LEAP is Cisco's been lately pushing this big program called Cisco CCX. I don't know what the acronym stands for, if somebody else does. But what Cisco is doing is they're licensing the LEAP software to other manufacturers, so you don't have to buy Cisco cards, Cisco Wi-Fi cards, to be able to use LEAP on your network. Now you can buy a Linksys card, a D-Link card, a 3Com card, whatever, and it comes bundled with the drivers to be able to do LEAP. The part that Cisco makes money on is when you buy APs. So if you want to do Cisco LEAP, you can only use Cisco APs, because that's intellectual property of Cisco. So the LEAP specification is only open to business partners of Cisco. like I said, the client is licensed to a bunch of other manufacturers. And what happens is these manufacturers license the client, and now you as the consumer see, oh, good, this extra thing is available. Now it's much easier for me to secure my wireless network with Cisco Leap because I don't have to go through the trouble of setting up an 802.0NX server. I don't need to buy steel-belted radius or any of that kind of stuff. I don't have to worry about distributing client software to all my clients because they already come with these drivers that I'm getting with these cards. So Cisco is making it very attractive, but when you use Leap, you're locked into always using Cisco APs, and that's where the cash cow comes in. Okay, so information here, just for my own disclaimer purposes, is derived from packet captures of Leap transactions, specifically through counting bits with Ethereal, and from this one post that's on the internet. I believe this slide's on the DEF CON CD, so if it's not, you can email me, and I'll get you a copy of it. Good, Mike. Thanks. So what does Leap do? Well, it makes the world a lot safer for everybody. So Leap actually uses a modified MSChat V2 challenge response authentication mechanism to make sure that you are who you say you are when you join a Leap network. It uses mutual authentication to mitigate man-in-the-middle attacks. So you're not only authenticated to the AP, but the AP authenticates itself to you. It uses short-lived web keys to encrypt data, and it prevents the usage of weak IVs from the access point. So this mitigates a lot, not all, of the effectiveness of tools like AirSnort and WebCrack and BSD AirTools. It does reduce the probability of IV collisions due to a randomized selection process. So when it doesn't use a sequential initialization vector counter, it actually uses a randomized value. Okay. So the weakness that I'm going to be talking about is actually in the MSChat V2 authentication challenge response. So what sucks about MSChat V2? There's no salt stored in NT hashes. So the NT hash is basically just an MD4 checksum of the file. Of the user's password, 16 bytes in length. That's it. No salt, so it's vulnerable to dictionary attacks. Dictionary attacks, however, can be very time-consuming, and I know all the attendants here with ADD just wouldn't have the time to be able to wait for that. Okay. It actually uses a weak DES key selection for the challenge response mechanism, and that weak DES key selection lets us discover the last 2 bytes of the user's NT hash. The usernames are sent in clear text, unlike TTLS and PEEP, which encrypt usernames and passwords, so that's not immediately obvious. And with all these flaws, we can actually deduce usernames and authentication passwords just by looking at the Leap challenge response mechanism. Okay. So the Leap station challenge response mechanism works like this. The AP issues an 8-byte challenge to the station. The station then accepts that 8-byte challenge, and they take their NT hash. They split that NT hash into 3 7-byte values to seed DES with. Each key is used to seed DES to encrypt the 8-byte output, the 8-byte challenge, which generates 8 bytes of output. The 3 times that happens generates a 24-byte response that is sent back to the access point. The access point then does the same process for the challenge response and makes sure that they match. That's how that authenticates the user. The DES key selection actually works like this. So it has to split the 16-byte value, the 16-byte NT hash, into 3 7-byte DES keys. DES key 1 are NT hash bytes 1 through 7. Key 2 are NT hash bytes 8 through 14. And NT hash, and the DES key 3, remember it's only 16 bytes in the NT hash. We use 7, 7, 14. That only leaves us 2 bytes left. So in MSChat V2, they actually use 5 null characters for that third DES seed. Okay, and after the AP receives that response to the challenge, it issues a success or failure message. Mike? Okay. So the problem here is that the response leaks 2 bytes of the user's hash, the last 2 bytes of the user's NT hash. The third DES key is weak. Because we're only using 2 unique bytes in that DES key, it only leaves us 2^8 possible permutations to be able to guess that key, that third DES key value, because we know the last 5 bytes are always null. So, and on a measly Pentium 2 233, I can calculate 2^8 DES challenge, DES encryption mechanisms in 2^8 16. 2 to the 16. Wow. Sorry. 2 to the power of 16, not 2 to the power of 8. I was smoking crack when I wrote this, and I just messed it all up. Sorry about that. So we're able to recover. The bottom line here is that we're able to recover the last 2 bytes of the user's NT hash. Why is this important? Because if we have a big pre-computed database of all the users and all potential passwords and NT hashes, we can significantly reduce the amount of search space we have to do on that by a factor of 2 to the power of 16. So in a simple example I put up here is, imagine grep ending byte 1, ending byte 2, matching to the end of the file of an NT hash dictionary, and that generates a list of possible passwords that we can use. So the bottom line here is it significantly reduces our search space in that big dictionary file to be able to find the user's password. And in my experience, from about 2.5 million passwords in a test dictionary that I was working with, it usually leaves about 30 guesses that I have to make. Okay. So what's our attack? Our attack is to take a large password list and pre-calculate the MD4 hashes for each entry in that list. So we take a big dictionary list. Myself, I took a 300 megabyte dictionary list, and then I added 01, 02, 03, 04 to the end of every password, and then I started changing O's to zeros and I's to ones, and I ended up with a really huge dictionary file when I was all done with it. I then pass that file through a tool that generates an indexed binary file for efficient lookups of the user's password, the clear text password, or the potential password, the dictionary word, and the 16-byte NT hash. So what I do then is once I get the challenge response mechanism from a Cisco Leap connection, I calculate the last 2 bytes with a third DES key weakness that I just talked about. I only look at those entries, and then I use each password to try to encrypt the challenge text that I got from the access point. I only have to do it about 30 times or so, like I said, in 2.5 million passwords, or 2.5 million dictionary words. And I can do that in about 10 seconds. So the matching entry, so when I match the NT hash, I've got the associated clear text password with it. Now I know the username and the password of the Leap authenticated user. Okay, so that's great when it's all in theory and everything, but where's the wares? Well, here they are. So it's a tool that I'm calling a Sleep Improved, because the first version really sucked. So a Sleep I thought was appropriate for Cisco, like a sleep behind the wheel when they decided that MSChat V2 was a good idea to do challenge response authentication. So GenKeys. GenKeys is the program that takes a huge dictionary list and then generates an MD4 hash of each word that it has in the dictionary list and writes it to a binary indexed file. On my Pentium 3, I was doing about 65,000 words a second, except when I was running Kismet, then it was about 40,000 words a second. So MD4 hashes are made to be fast and efficient. So with the appropriate amount of disk space, you could, in one instance, you only have to do it once, generate a very, very large indexed file to be able to use for potential matches to a user's password. So the Sleep tool. The Sleep tool does a couple of things. It reads from either a PCAP stored file or from a live network interface in RFMON mode, and it watches for the Leap challenge response mechanism. It calculates the last 2 bytes of the NT hash, it searches the GenKeys output file for matches, and then it reports the user's password. Okay. So that was pretty much V1 of a Sleep, so I thought, well, I should probably add some features because I'm sick and tired of waiting for people to authenticate to their Leap networks. So what I added was a search mode, and the search mode actually does channel hopping to go between all the channels that are available on your card and then look for any data traffic on every channel. It has an active mode. So the active mode identifies active stations on the network. So if it sees a data packet to DS, to the distribution system on the network, it identifies that as an active node on the network. It injects a Sleep tool injects a spoofed deauthenticate leap logoff, a leap logoff frame followed by a deauthenticate frame to that station, on behalf of the access point. So the station receiving that packet says, oh, the access point's telling me to log off. That's perfectly legitimate. They might be low on resources, or they might be load balancing, or whatever. I'm going to reauthenticate now. That forces them to reauthenticate, so it makes significantly less waiting for me to make that happen. Thank you. And a feature I just added was to maintain a binary AVL tree to maintain the all the stations that I've seen in the network, so I only have to attack each station once. I don't have to blindly keep attacking stations that I've already found their passwords. Another feature is that it saves a leap exchange into a PCAP file. So I only need three frames. I need the challenge, I need the response, and I need the success or failure message. The sleep tool is smart enough only to give me when there's to only try to crack passwords when it's a successful authentication. We don't want fat fingered passwords because that just wastes our battery time. But the feature of the WTAP file is this. I've got an IPAC running familiar. The tool compiles on ARM. I can run that tool and it will be in active mode and it will just dump all those challenge response packets to a different file. I can take that challenge response file to a big system like a Spark system, a Sun system with a huge amount of disk and a huge dictionary password, and I can just go to town on that system. So it works out very well. Mike? Okay, a little demonstration.
I do not have a Cisco access point.
So the GenKeys program just takes an input file and an output file. So for this particular case, I've got this big dictionary file of one password per line.
Yeah, these are really probable user passwords. It's just sorted, so.
So I already ran that through the GenKeys program so you guys wouldn't have to see that, but the GenKeys output file just reports as data. So if I want to run a sleep, I just say run a sleep. I'm going to identify what the nthash file is. Better?
Thanks, man.
So I'm just going to do a very basic test. We don't have a live Leap network here for me to test, but I'm just going to pass Leap -F for the GenKeys binary output file and stored PCAP file I have on the system here. And so immediately it finds the username information and it calculates, it has a challenge and response, and in less than a second it calculated the hash byte, the last few values of the hash bytes, and there you go. It calculates the, it reports the NT hash and the user's password at the end of the file. How about that, huh? And of course, my favorite username, Tim's mom. Who also has the user password. All right. Okay, can we get the lights back on? Okay, a couple of last points. Cisco, as of 20 minutes ago, released a PCERT advisory on this weakness, so that's up on the website. Thank you very much to my friend John Stewart for taking care of that for us. So I'm working with Cisco on a little bit of ethical disclosure kind of stuff, but shortly thereafter, this tool will be made available, and if you just watch the BugTrack mailing list, I'm sure you'll catch up on the post. So I've got a couple of minutes, I think, for any questions. All right. It was that good. Everybody understands everything about MSChef V2, and that's awesome. Your question? Okay, so the question is, if I pick a binary password, you're not going to be able to crack it, right? Or a difficult password, a recommended good strong password, right? And the answer is, sorry?
I was going to say not password.
Okay, yeah, not password, right? Okay. Well, and the answer is no. The tool is only going to be able to find users' passwords that have matching passwords in your dictionary file. It is still a dictionary attack. It's just much more improved because of the weakness in the NT in the third DES key value there. There are potential improvements to this. How many people saw the Slashdot article or read the paper on the LASIK MSChef V1 challenge where they used binary hash tables to do fast and efficient password lookups? The speed time trade-off paper?
Your users use stupid passwords. This is not a valid scenario in that they used a good password because I've yet to see it. Your users are dumb and you know this. That's why you don't give people your shadow file. People couldn't correct that if it was a perfect password. This is the same thing.
I was actually discussing this very issue with somebody from Cisco a couple of days ago, and I asked, are there any password auditing features in, like, Cisco Secure ECS where you can expire invalid passwords or passwords that are weak and can be cracked? And the answer was, well, no, that's an interesting feature, though. So, you know, but an excellent question, excellent question. Okay, anything else? Sir? Well, I'd be releasing the dictionary, the big dict. That was not my joke. Sure. If I can put it up on SourceForge and I have to pay for the bandwidth, yeah, sure. But you know, you want to use a password dictionary that is appropriate for you. I did include a couple of Perl scripts in here that'll run through your dictionary file and make it freaking huge. So just with all the common permutations of, I know, I'll make my, you know, password with an E, with a 3 instead, because nobody will ever guess that. So just some stupid shit like that. Yeah, right. So the comment was, you could use a two-line dictionary password with password and Cisco in there, just like Cisco routers are. So an excellent piece of recommendation. Yeah. Okay, the question is, does Peep use MSChef V2? And the answer is yes, it does. But Peep uses a TLS tunnel to encrypt MSChef V2, so it is not vulnerable to this kind of attack. We'll see how it's vulnerable in a little while. All right, thank you, everybody. It's my pleasure to introduce Anton Rager, who's going to be spending some time talking about his new attack tool. Anton?
We figured out this one works with the sword. Yeah. I just can't pull it over here. I'll just stand up. Somebody else drives. Okay.
Yeah. My name is Anton Rager, and go ahead and jump to the next slide. I want to talk a little bit about injection attacks on WEP. Most people, when you think about WEP, you're thinking about how do you break the keys. Most of the tools that are out there, people are trying to run AirSnort or WEPCrack or other sorts of tools like dWEPCrack that are actually iterating through weak initialization vectors to try to derive the actual key so that then you can associate and log on to the AP and actually be a valid user. But that takes a lot of time, and it takes quite a bit of data to be able to collect enough data to be able to break the keys. Turns out that it's much easier to come up with ways that I can just inject traffic into your network. And so I can craft arbitrary packets, inject it into your network, and I'm not really worried about knowing your encryption key. I'm just utilizing the fact that WEP is RC4, and it's easy to derive some of the key stream from each of the packets and then just replay that same key stream, XORing it against different data. So here's kind of the rundown of an attack like an injection attack. We need to know a key stream for a specific initialization vector. There's two ways that are already publicly known. One way is very difficult to actually pull off, relying on DHCP discovery frames, and it turns out it's very specific to Windows, and the way that Windows sends out a DHCP discovery, you have a lot of known plain text. Known plain text gives you the actual key stream for that IV, because you can just XOR it against the ciphertext, and now you have the key stream that you can re-encrypt with your own data. Shared key authentication. Last year, this gentleman here came up with this attack, which is shared key authentication has a tremendous amount of plain text. It's known. It's actually how the authentication process works. It sends a challenge, which is clear text, and the client turns around and sends an encrypted response of the exact same clear text encrypted. So now you have the clear text and the ciphertext, and you XOR the two, and you get the key stream. It's really smart of them. You know, not only is it a really bad authentication mechanism, it gives you material that you can now use to re-inject into that network using the same IV over and over. There's another one that I will just cover real briefly that I'm still in the process of working on and finishing up, and that has to do with IV collisions of mixed protocols. So specifically, and I'll talk a little bit more about it, but if you have an IV collision that involves an ARP frame and an IP frame, if you lay the two out next to each other, it turns out they reveal pieces of each other that you can then use to come up with known plain text. That's something that occurs more often than, say, looking for weak IVs. You know, it's much more likely to occur than waiting for 7 million IVs to go by. So after you have that, you now create your own frame, your own IP packet, and you put whatever text you want to in it and re-XOR it against the key stream, and then you send it back to the access point for the IV that you captured that maybe was with the shared key authentication. And the AP will accept it, or a node will accept it as a valid WEP frame, as long as you calculate the ICV and it looks like a valid frame. What you have is you have a transmit-only attack channel, because you really can't read what your responses are. You can inject all day long, but you don't know exactly what's coming back. You can summarize it maybe, but you don't actually always know. Go ahead, Josh. So there you go. I'm not sure I can really completely summarize it there, but basically replaying traffic that you know to get other IVs that have the same initial payload, I think is what he said.
So you need a key stream for all the IVs.
Yeah.
So then you can decrypt.
So go ahead and jump to the next slide. And this is just kind of a visual on the IV collisions between two different types of protocols, specifically ARP and IP. It's kind of a high-level summary, but it turns out that the IP addresses in the known plain text within an ARP frame, such as you know what the source MAC is, and you know your ARP header information, like protocol size, things like that, that's all known plain text. And it reveals things that you don't know or that maybe you do know in the IP frame. And it turns out that two of the things that it initially reveals are 2 bytes of your source IP. And generally, if both of those happen to be sourced from the same network, leaving to the access point to go to another network, then now you can begin to plug some of this in. So go ahead and, Mike?
Mike.
Shiny object.
Hey.
All right, that's good. So now you can take that same value you already revealed, and you can plug that value in to your requesting IP because they're on the same network, and say it's 10.10.10.something. You've revealed the first two source IP bytes in the IP frame, and you can now take those values, plug them into your unknown piece of the ARP frame, and reveal additional bytes within the IP frame. Anyway, you basically unravel the two frames with each other, and it becomes a little more difficult to go out further, but it is possible in some situations to be able to reveal enough of a keystream using this method that you can actually insert arbitrary TCP, UDP, and ICMP frames into the network. You have enough contiguous keystream that you can now XOR any frame that you want to that's within a reasonable size. And one of the things that makes that happen is it turns out that a lot of Ethernet drivers or Ethernet cards, I'm not real sure exactly which is doing this, ZeroPad, the trailers that they have, like for an ARP, it's not a trailer. What's it called when it's still an Ethernet? What's that? No? The trailer? Okay. So you end up with a trailer field. A lot of times that's zero padded. You can generally determine whether or not it's going to be zero padded or not by a specific MAC address for a vendor. It tends to be tied to a vendor. And baseline information, you can now reveal an awful lot more of the frame, and you have the potential to completely unravel this key stream that you can then replay into the network. There's some things you have to brute force, but it's fairly quick brute force process, and you've got some ways that you can validate it. So I'm not going to go into a lot more detail on it, but that's just kind of a high level, a visual of how the two frames lay out, summarized. So let's jump to the next slide. So if I can inject traffic into your network, what does this mean? Well, if I can inject arbitrary traffic into somebody's network and they have a firewall and they have access to the internet and I have a box that's sitting on the internet that I also own, then I can monitor what I'm injecting. And so immediately by using that and taking advantage of the fact that they probably have some sort of connectivity to the internet through a firewall, I can start mapping out what the firewall rule set may look like. And so I can inject TCP frames, UDP frames, ICMP frames, different ports, things like that, and try to figure out what's the firewall rule set. Well, this is also kind of useful to figure out what the firewall is going to allow me to do a little bit later. So I can now begin to spoof some frames to make it appear that I'm trying to ping somebody valid on the inside of the network and have the responses to that ping go to this host that I own that's on the internet. Same thing with port scanning. This requires a few more tricks in the firewall. I have to start poking state tables in the NAT state engine to be able to get, you know, like the ICMP unreachable or protocol and port unreachable messages to come back through and actually get through the firewall. The interesting thing about UDP port scans is that once I do, you know, just like traditional UDP port scanning, if I don't get an ICMP port unreachable message, then that means there's probably something there. That also means that there is a hole that's created in that firewall now. And so let's say that I port scan for SNMP and I didn't get a response saying that the port is unreachable, and I know that the firewall will pass SNMP because I've kind of already played with that earlier in this attack. And so I don't get that response within a specific time interval. I now have a hole that's poked in the firewall, and I can do an SNMP get from the outside from this box that I own on the internet, come straight back in through the firewall, have a direct connection to this host that the firewall thinks that the host created itself, although I actually spoofed the traffic and injected it in. TCP port scanning is also possible. The one roadblock with TCP scanning is that it's, you really can't take it to the next step like you can with UDP as easily, but you can get RSTs through the firewall, and so you can know whether or not a service is listening. I think it's possible to extend it into poking a big hole through the firewall so that, you know, after you do a port scan on Telnet, you can actually get the Telnet banner from your external host, but it's going to take a little bit more work. So let's jump to the next slide. And go ahead and hit the spacebar one more time. This is just kind of laying out what I was talking about. We've got a host that's attacking an 802.11 network and some internal target. They happen to be connected to the internet, and there's another host that I own that's on the internet. So I've got two hosts, the yellow ones I own, the red ones what I'm attacking, and I don't have their web keys or anything. I'm just using these injection attacks to try to figure out what's running on this host. So I can inject traffic into the host, spoofing the actual source address of an internet host, and this target, go ahead and hit space, will then respond back to my internet host. So you're tricking the target into forwarding your traffic back out the firewall. Now, there's more tricks to it than the simplistic view, in that I have to send some traffic first, spoofing that it looks like the target source address to my internet host to create some state tables in the firewall. Then it will allow me to spoof that, you know, this internet host is trying to talk to this target, and it'll respond over the internet. Go ahead and hit the next slide. The cool thing is you can put all this on one host. And so if I have a CDMA modem, or if I have a CDPD modem and an 802.11 card, I can be sitting in a parking lot and have an internet connection that's potentially unnatted that I can get to, and an 802.11 network that I can inject into. Go ahead and hit the spacebar a couple of times. Same idea. I inject, and the responses come back through the internet to my other interface. And so if you can imagine ScanRAN or maybe even InMap that's broken into two separate interfaces, and you're injecting on 802.11 that you really can't monitor the responses, and you're monitoring responses over CDMA, that's kind of the concept. Go ahead and jump to the next slide. So I have a little bit of a proof of concept tool here that's called WebWedgie, and WebWedgie takes advantage of this. Currently, although it says that it's supposed to deal with the ARPA-IV collisions, I am still working on that part of the code. There's a very alpha code that's going to be posted here in a few minutes after I get done with this. And it does the keystream determination via the pre-shared key authentication. So if somebody is using pre-shared key authentication, it derives the keystream that you need, which is a fairly significantly sized keystream. You can craft some really big packets. And then using AirJack does some injection attacks. You can use CDMA or CDPD for the secondary interface, but currently it's doing all the injection stuff, and I don't actually have it to where it's doing the more of the port scanning in correlation on what ports are open and what ports aren't open, but it is doing the injection, and it's doing it based on the shared key authentication. So the next version will actually be doing the correlation on the back end to do the UDP TCP port scanning, as well as ping scanning and the firewall rule mapping. Right now it's a bit of a manual process, so you need to run TCP dump and look at it and see what the responses are, or run it through your own Perl script to try to do something interesting with it. I think I got a quick demo, as long as nobody crashes me in the process. And if they crash me, I think I get to hit Mike.
You know, the cool thing, well, and you're talking about for the IV collision attacks?
Yeah.
IV collision attacks, if it's the same IV, you can XOR between the two frames. And the LLCs are going to be different XORs. And the XORs are going to be the same encrypted that they would be if they were unencrypted. And so you can just see what the delta should be for an ARC versus an IP. And you automatically know, I got a match. And then you can start playing around to see which one's the ARC and which one's the IP. And then go through the unroll. And hopefully nobody will crash me, and hopefully my system will run, and hopefully my code will run. But I get to hit Mike. Because he's the only one who really could do that.
I don't have a purpose.
What the hell?
That's a serial port on top.
Someday I'm going to learn how to use these damn computers.
There's a reason why
we've
been
to Finn.
Anton.
Hey, whatever. Hey, Token Ring was great, man. Don't knock Token Ring. I'm still run my house on it. Oh, I can't see. So what we have here is this program has two different components to it currently. The first component is actually what captures the PRGA stream, and it's very simply called PRGA SNARP. And it uses AirJack, and basically you can do this with PCAP as well. And it just monitors for authentication sequences at 802.11. So you can see there's a lot of people out here that are doing open authentication. I pretty much ignore anything that's just open authentication. And the system died.
please stop.
So.
I didn't do it. That's right.
When did you get to hit him?
Can I hit him now?
Go for it.
Oh, it's the monkey key thingy.
Somebody turn the light on just for a second. Thank you. Well, that's nice.
Anton, you want to get that hooked up and let the other guys go? We'll do
it
at the end.
I can demo it in a little while. Okay. Just go ahead and do that. I'll play around with it. Yeah.
We're running short on time, so Anton's going to do his demonstration of the Upwedgie tool at the end of the session. So please stick around if you want to see that. Anton Rieger, thank you. All right, is anybody still sober? No? Okay. Well, we got a couple more presenters. I'm very pleased to introduce Akari, who's going to be speaking about some attacks, some weaknesses of web vulnerabilities. Take it away.
I'm not going to really present too much new stuff. I've had this stuff out for about a year now, and I've just finally gotten off my ass and actually done kind of a beta release.
Let me switch over to this. It's kind of hard to see, but can everybody see that? No? Not really?
Hey, Carl, you want to come over here?
What's that? Okay. I'm just going to talk about some web stuff because you've seen Kismet. It's so much better than DStumbler. So if you really want something better than DStumbler, use Kismet, okay? I've heard that 3.0 does. It runs on open. Well, then you'll have to put up with DStumbler if you're running FreeBSD, okay? First of all, how many people here use BSD? Okay. Not bad. I have at least some people going for me here. I'm Hikari, David Holton, whatever. I run the BSD Air Tools project, and I've released a white paper called Practical Exploitation of RC4 Weaknesses in Web Environments, and it basically just outlines some optimizations to RC4 cracking and stuff. And that's mainly what I'm going to be talking about today. Skip this. Basically, past, present, and future. This is stuff that everybody knows. I'm just going to review this in case anybody doesn't know about web cracking and stuff like that. WEP stands for Wired Equivalent Privacy, and it uses RC4, and this is a bunch of copied slides from an old presentation, so it says 40-bit and 104-bit, but as you know, there's also the 256-bit, which is actually 128-bit and stuff like that. But basically, the older stuff uses 24-bit IVs, and I believe that the new stuff uses 128-bit IVs. Okay, well, if anybody wants to correct me, you can correct me later, but that's all that I know. As far as 40-bit, 40-bit, if you use the key generator with your Linksys access point or whatever, Tim Newsham pointed out a couple years ago that you can easily crack it in roughly about, 15 seconds or so, 20 seconds. Really depends. It's really fast. You only have to crack 21 bits. Properly generated 40-bit requires about 50 days or one day or on the fly.
Historically speaking, one day if you're on the right system. Thank you for that system. You know who you are.
And 104-bit still takes a little while to crack. The way that we usually get around this is the FMS attack or the PRGA attacks that Anton mentioned earlier. And with dwebcrack, it usually requires about 500,000 to 2 million packets to crack web. I understand that AirSnort says that it takes about 5 to 6 million, and I'm not sure. Does anybody here work on AirSnort with Shmoo or anything like that? Okay, well, I'll have to talk to him later about it because I've never run it. But either way, I've heard from a lot of people that it's a lot faster and requires a lot less packets. And it works with 40-bit and 104-bit with FMS attack. Basically, it essentially reduces the key space. So most of the time, you still have to brute force through a lot of different keys, but it reduces it dramatically by just capturing, 500,000 to 2 million packets. You can crack it in under a minute or so. So Tim Newsham pointed out the 21-bit attack, and that's included in dwebcrack. You can run it on a captured log file. All you need is two packets, and you can crack it in, you know, like 20 seconds or so. With 40-bit and 104-bit, you can brute force it, you know, as I said. It also takes Word files for 40-bit and 104-bit. And so, you know, you could do the same attacks that he pointed out, where you have a big-ass Word file. And it, of course, does the FMS attack and includes all the optimizations that I outlined in the white paper. So basically, it efficiently uses all the weak IVs and, well, almost all of them, and does it fairly fast. And if anybody can think of any way to do it faster, I'd like to talk to you. So, I've implemented some faster searching and stuff like that. But that's enough with dwebcrack. Right now in the present, these are some things that I've developed about a year ago, and it's just been kind of like in CVS and stuff, just kind of, you know, hanging out there. And basically, I developed a really simple packet creation and injection library for 802.11, which is very similar to libradiate, but it requires a lot less modification, you know, like using your own driver and stuff like that. And it's a really simple library. I mean, last DEF CON, I coded it, like, during DEF CON for about, I just spent about 4 hours or so. And it's just a really simple interface, and it includes various patches to the OpenBSD kernel so you can inject packets fairly easily. With dinject, I basically took this library and just made it command line based. So if you want to send out a probe response, beacon packet, whatever, you can just run a simple command with, you know, a set of options and inject them. And so it allows you to, you know, proof different things. What is that?
It's an unhappy system.
And so I've also have this available for anybody that wants to use it. You can do fake AP in about, you know, like 4 lines of shell code. You know, there's lots of stuff you can easily do with this. I basically with injection, the stuff that I have is really rudimentary, and it has lots and lots of cons. Basically, it's not reliable. It requires you have to have like the right card that, you know, supports mode 5 and all that kind of stuff, and it really sucks. It really does suck. So hopefully some people will be releasing. Yeah, go ahead. What's that? Yeah, hopefully people will be releasing stuff a lot better than this in the near future. Hint, hint, hint. And then hopefully other people will be porting it to BSD. Oh, okay. Oh, cool. Oh, okay. Nice. So, one thing that I kind of came up with a while ago was traffic generation. Basically, for cracking web faster, you can do simple stuff like determine if packets are ARPs or TCP, you know, small TCP packets and stuff like that, by just looking at their sizes. ARPs have pretty much a fixed size depending on the operating system, as well as like TCP SYNs, ACKs, and RSTs, FINs, whatever. And so basically, the attack is really simple. You just look for these packets, and if you see one, you re-inject it onto the network, because WEP is totally vulnerable to replay attacks and that sort of thing. So this is basically how it works. A node sends like an ARP request across the wireless network that's encrypted, and hits the access point or, you know, another host or whatever. And the attacker sees this ARP request and determines that it's probably an ARP request based on the length. Just grabs it, re-injects it. You know, the access point or other host sees another ARP request, and of course it, you know, sends an ARP response back for, you know, the previous one and the one that you injected and the 10,000 more that you injected that second. And so you can just, you know, crank through IVs really fast and achieve your 500,000 to 2 million packets fairly fast, which would be a lot better if we have a really good driver for injection. And with TCP, you actually get a couple packets back, and so, and it's all technicalities, but basically it's a really simple attack for just generating traffic and cracking web faster. In lab results, it takes me about like an hour to generate enough weak IVs to crack web, with like one ARP or one TCP packet or whatever. But if we had a better driver, it could be done a lot faster. it really varies with hardware that filters weak IVs as far as web cracking and stuff like that. So it really depends on how good their weak IV filter is.
Kai.
Yes.
We got to close up for.
Yeah. It's about three or four more slides.
Okay.
So future stuff that I believe we're going to be seeing is ANG stuff. It'd be nice to have a monitor mode driver for that. Is there one? Okay. Analyzing WEP2, the 256-bit WEP stuff. Getting into some frequency hopping stuff. And, the layer one stuff, you know, like the nice driver for injecting stuff. These are just different links to Doc Bowden projects, myself. But here's a zero day, so if anybody wants to grab the beta release, then you can grab it from here or just email me or something like that. But that's pretty much it. So.
Thanks, Akari. I think it's really important to point out, too, it's immediately obvious to us up here, but maybe not to everybody else, the attacks Akari is talking about and the attacks Anton are talking about are vulnerable to all kinds of WEP, not just static WEP, I never changed my WEP key, but to tumbling WEP, PEEP, TTLS. Those attacks still rely on WEP, so these attacks also apply to those protocols as well. You doing that, Mike? I should point out that we have some swag to hand out, too, so stick around. We'll be throwing that at the audience in a little while.
I love my job.
Sorry, you had a comment about like access points with weak IVs and how often are you finding them? It seems to me that most access points nowadays really just don't send out a package with weak IVs.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of them out nowadays.
Use the mic, Akari.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of them out nowadays, and there's some that do the weak IV filtering properly, and there's some that don't. What's that? And so I've seen a couple that just, you know, bypass the baseline attack, and so they'd still be vulnerable to the, you know, numerous IVs that also the ones that people forgot to implement when they were doing their web cracking applications. Yeah. We got to get on, so...
I made you stand up.
Okay, my laptop is sucking, so it's just a slide, so I'll wing it. I'm a Abaddon. You may remember me from such things as taking down the network last year at DEF CON, and the whole man-in-the-middle stuff that Cisco was trying to mitigate with Leap, that was me and Mr. Robert Baird out there. Okay, so the other work I do, most of you probably haven't heard about because it's mostly a bunch of drivers for guys like these. I was the one he was hinting at the whole time there. I work on AirJack 1. All it does is injection stuff. It's a lot of people have used HostAP to do that. The problem with HostAP is it's not meant to do that. It's meant to be an access point. And so you have a huge limitations. AirJack was specifically meant to inject traffic. That was AirJack 1. AirJack 2, I got a lot of complaints for a lot of things. One, it required a Prism 2 card. Nobody has Prism 2 cards. Not really making those very many places. It only ran on Linux. It didn't support station mode or access point mode or anything like that. So I started work on AirJack 2, which should be something of a release. this weekend-ish. if you want to run it, have a journaling file system. okay, stable. but the new AirJack 2 is actually got three layers. It's got an OS independent layer, and that's why it's going to be running on right now the code is for Linux that's doing anything useful. I told Hikari, I have about 1,000 lines of so far the BSD code because it's going to be going to OS X, and then I've decided I'm going to put it on Windows eventually. I'm not giving you a date, but it will be made for Windows because I wanted to learn the Windows driver programming. But basically, the reason why you care about this is because they're tools when I work on all your other platforms. I also put in a bus independent layer so you can use USB cards with it and card bus cards with it, which is why I'm able to do the 802.11a and G stuff with it now. You can also use PCI or Compact Flash or PCMCA. Additionally, it has an abstraction layer. It's three abstraction layers. The third one is for the chipsets, which should work on most cards. There's two particular chipsets I'm not going to be able to write drivers on because of NDAs with my work, but I'm not going to get into it. I've got two people that I'm going to beat until they write it. So you'll have it for all of them. Right now, it's coming out with the Prism 2, and it'll do the Hermes chipset as well. It's a Lucent card. Sometime next week, maybe they'll have the USB stuff fully working. And then hopefully by the end of August, I'll have it working on NetBSD, and then hopefully OpenBSD and FreeBSD after that. And OS X, if I can borrow a friend's laptop. but like I said, pretty much. Chicks dig AirJack. That's what the slide said. It also repeated that Scene Whores dig AirJack, and also that Tim's mother digs AirJack. So that was on the slide. It's not quite as funny when I'm reading it, but all right, okay. So there's one other thing that Anton left off that I'm going to be really vague about because it's funny. There is a much dramatically better way to get to the keystreams, and someone's done it. Tacky is not released yet. It might be in the future. That's dramatically better. I don't know. Does anybody have any questions as far as right now it should be supporting station mode and ad hoc mode. I'll have the AP mode stuff in there. So you don't need to switch drivers between
URL.
Oh yeah. Okay, it's 802.11ninja.net as in 802 is a subdomain. I'm clever. Yeah. 11ninja.net. /airjack, that's where all the AirJack stuff is. Email Abaddon at 802.11ninja.net or go to the website, and we've got a mailing list going. Three of them if you're interested in it. I don't really have to terribly much more to say about that. We have questions about, anything really. I mean, we have time for everybody, but specifically for the moment about, the drivers and what we can do. And it's mostly meant so that you can do injection stuff, but you won't have to switch drivers to use all the other features, connect to an access point normally. So.
Switch drivers for Linux for 802.11a and g.
Yeah, it'll do that.
Very important feature.
And it should do that for BSD as well. No one? It doesn't now, but it's pretty easy to do it. It's like you fill in like 20 stubbed functions and poof, it works on that card. Because it's got a lot of abstraction in there. Anybody? Anybody questions for them? Or? Sure. Oh, sorry. He asked if I'm still going to be supporting Intersil stuff, even though they're not doing their wireless anymore. Yes. Yes, it is. But, yeah. It should work. I have to beat somebody into doing the Aeronet and the Atheros, because I have NDAs. But the card bus stuff for that should work. Anyone? He asked, what are my thoughts on 802.11i and WPA? I can answer that first, and then I'm sure some of these people are going to want to get in on that. My thoughts on WPA, as far as TKIP and MIC, nice try, but I don't really have much faith in it. 802.11i is a little better, but I'd really want to see. The problem with 802.11i is you're not going to be able to put it on the old cards. It simply doesn't have the horsepower to handle AES. The newer ones are running on much, much faster Mac processors, so they can do it. And so hopefully we'll see, once everybody's using 802.11a, you know, A or G, or hopefully just G, we'll be able to have the horsepower to do that. But until then, it's mostly a problem with horsepower on the access points, because you can do it on the host CPU. But as far as WPA goes, I don't have much faith. Those hashing functions that it's based on are really, really weak.
And it's still RC4 at the core. You
yeah.
basically have WEP with a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, it is exactly WEP.
It's somewhat secure, but it's still a trade-off between security and performance for the processors that are in all the APs.
Yes.
So those APs are not going to be able to run AES CCM.
So this, really gonna have more stuff. I'm going to start giving out swag people with good questions. Someone's got a good question, we're giving out swags.
Yeah.
So, whoever just asked that question, come pick swag. And somebody else with a good question. Yeah, you in the back, not Jim. yeah. Just email Tim's mom at 802.11ninja.net.
It's a pop account.
Yeah. Yes.
Wait, I'll check it real quick.
Mm-hmm. I did see that. Part of their problem was that they were... I'm sorry, again. Yeah, I was bitching at you to do that. He asked if I'd seen anything to implement anything with the Nokias. They put out a paper about problems with tunneled authentication protocols, tunneled through TLS, and if I try to implement anything with that. My understanding with that, which is not too terribly extensive, I read it, but I sort of skimmed past it, is that they were relying on a weakness in the client, and I didn't see an actual specific mention of the weakness. They're right in that it's one-way authentication in the same way, but if in that they're really only authenticating the server to do the TLS. But I didn't really see the actual weakness in the client that was specifically mentioned. It's just they were talking about it's a bad best practice, which is true. I agree, but it's a lot better than, say, Leap.
Can I answer that?
Yeah, go.
Basically said that in these protocols, PEEP and TTLS are using encrypted, strong encryption outer tunnels for weak authentication passwords inside a tunnel. The problem is that the client doesn't know whether or not it's talking through an encrypted tunnel or not through an encrypted tunnel. So it's possible in some client implementations to fool the client into thinking that a secure tunnel exists when it actually does not, and then derive the credentials. But in practice, I don't think anybody's seen that. But that's a good question.
Yeah. Also, something else to point out is that a lot of those authentication things that are using EAP use static broadcast keys. Those are keys where they send traffic to broadcast, which makes them very, 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 very vulnerable to the stuff that Hikari and Anton were talking about, because you can send it to the broadcast address. Even if you needed a unicast IP, you can put that right on a frame that has a broadcast MAC. I've seen symbols have been compliant for a long time. They do make APs. They make APs and have made APs for a long time, but they're not really the kind that you buy someplace. You get them for warehouse and point of sale. But they've had WPA for a long time. Cisco does it right now. If you get their latest stuff, I'm pretty sure the new iOS and the 1200 series will do it. I couldn't even really tell you. Mm-hmm. But the 1200 series has a little power PC in it. It's pretty powerful. Hmm? Intermec? Okay. He says Intermec might be. So, yes?
What's the best hope for getting
802.11
security running?
Say it again. Well, he asked what's the best hope for getting 802.11 security running, is that what you said?
Right.
Everybody start yelling at, actually, both of you two, it's swag. You too, if you want. The major problem with that is IEEE isn't listening to people, really. They did try with the WPA stuff. They really did try. They also did a pretty decent job on the 802.11i, but it's just not there. I mean, yes.
The other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, it took 6 or 7 years for IPsec to go through the standards body, and we all kind of respect IPsec. 802.11i is still a year away before it's finally ratified, and I think 802.11i is the closest to something that you can probably trust for 802.11 security.
Yeah.
And don't fool yourself into thinking that your IPsec implementations are secure for wireless networks, because frankly, I have yet to see an IPsec implementation that did not have problems with it.
Oh, yeah.
Not the kind of problems we're talking about, but layer 2 problems, you're still vulnerable to all kinds of denial of service attacks. And client configurations is the biggest thing, right, man?
If you're not using strong authentication read as PKI. If you're not using strong authentication with it, you're wasting your time. I demonstrated that at Black Hat last year with Rob Baird.
How many people have patched all the clients that are vulnerable to the DCOM vulnerability, all the XP machines that you have? Yeah. If you're running IPsec in your wireless network, I bet you those machines are still vulnerable to attack.
Yeah. I would have to say that the one thing that makes PEEP good is that Cisco says so, which is not really a good reason. But that's what Cisco will tell you. I can't really say which one's necessarily better. They both have their problems. I would lean towards the one that's a little more open. But
I would prefer TTLS because you've got a lot more flexibility with different protocols and how you can use it, and it's still got the same level of security in that TLS tunnel that PEEP does.
Schwag. Yeah. That and MSChat V2 doesn't give me a warm, fuzzy feeling. My immediate thoughts with the Leap stuff was, you know, Cisco and MS, meaning Microsoft in MSChat. Cisco and Microsoft, the dynamic duo, out to secure your network. And who doesn't trust that? He asked if we run wireless networks in our houses and how would we secure them if we did. I can answer that one right now. I run one at my house. It's pretty open. The SSID is free porn. And the way that I handle security is that I don't use it for things I don't want people seeing or getting on. And it's not connected to the rest of the network. It basically is there so people can get on the internet. And what do they do on the internet but free porn? You have to ask these guys.
I run one in my house. I live in an old apartment that's basically a Faraday cage. You're lucky if you can see it from my front yard.
I live in the middle of nowhere, so if you get close enough to actually point an antenna at me, I can probably hit you with a 30-30. So. I run web and some of the dynamic authentication stuff like Leap.
We have big antennas outside of our place, but we don't run wireless.
Yeah.
I'm fucking paranoid. I use the Kismet drone sensors outside my house to monitor the network and do some custom real-time reporting stuff to find out what's going on. But basically, you know, if you want to drive over to my house and sit in front, you know, knock on the door, say hello, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
Don't sit in my parking lot.
Hold on. Get a...
Get some swag.
Yeah. He asked if I've ever seen anybody talking about exploiting the Michael countermeasures problem. The Michael countermeasures problem. Michael, incidentally, is the message integrity check that they have on TKIP. Michael is a very, bad hash function. They had reasons. They're not completely bad. The guys were given sort of an impossible task. They had to make a good hash function that could run on a CPU that can't do anything. And it had to run really fast. So that's why it was bad. But it's so bad, in fact, that if they get too bad, badly authenticated, it has a good CRC, so they know it encrypted properly, but it has a bad MIC hash on it, then if they get two of those within a minute, I believe, then it disconnects you. Within a second, is it? Okay, well, one of those two, and it disconnects you. Problem with that is, I haven't actually tried this specifically to know for sure that it works, but there was some talk a long time ago about the you could do bit flipping inside the RC4 because it's still an RC4 system and get the CRC to come out valid. Now, I can't do bit flipping to get the MIC come out valid, but I don't need to. If I get two that come out invalid but the encryption was good, you're off the network. I haven't seen it in the wild. You'd have to ask these guys. Anybody seen it in the wild? I haven't seen much WPA in the wild. Expect to see it in the wild when there's a lot of WPA out there. And it's a really bad DOS attack.
Yeah, so for people who don't know, the countermeasure is two invalid MIC packets. The AP has to shut down for an entire minute. That's part of the standard. The authenticator's all clients.
Yeah, it kicks you off. Yeah.
Part of the standard says you cannot have that option to be turned off. If you're a standards compliant product, you're not supposed to leave that as an option that the user can set.
Don't be standards compliant, please.
We already have enough insecure protocols. Now, on implementation, I think everything has had a shut off for that.
Yeah. So we already have enough insecure protocols, so one more won't hurt. Let somebody have an ask for you.
Even without standardization, do you think vendors will lean towards fixing this problem so you can get a little less
confusing? I think that's really in large part up to the people in this room and the guys you know, in my opinion. Because you guys, two groups, you guys are the ones who are going to be bitching to fix it, and you guys are the ones who are going to be breaking it and making other people bitch to fix it. If enough people are concerned about it, yes. But in my personal experience, people don't want security. They want a rubber stamp that says they're secure. So to that end, if it becomes a demand, they absolutely are going to have to. And 802.11i and some of the higher end hardware, the new 802.11g stuff will do it. But as is right now, I don't really see them fixing it because it's not a high priority of them.
It's been 2 years.
There will be standardization if somebody else has to do it, I'm sure. I mean, the WPA stuff was not done by IEEE. That was done by the Wi-Fi group, was it not?
No, it was done by both.
Was it both?
Yeah, it was actually created to 802.11i.
Yeah, I know it was based on 802.11i, which is IEEE. But, so... I don't know who you've been talking to, but I didn't do it.
Oh, yeah. Go to Bruce Potter's session on AirStorm.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll stay up to that. I don't want to steal Bruce's thunder for a session.
Well, hold on. I've been. Anybody new? Hold on. Right. Give me a second. You? He asked if SSL. He asked if SSL-based security is better than IPsec bumping out of the layer. There's a viable solution. Okay, in some cases, the problem with that is, well, a problem with that is, it's only authenticating the server using, you know, web-style SSL stuff generally, which means you have a signed certificate from the server, so it's one-way authenticated. The other major problem is that is your users are very stupid and will click yes. It's all just techno jargon. It, what do you mean it's not signed by them? I just want my Yahoo. She asked how effective it is to disable SSID broadcasting. That's sort of, in my opinion, a confused question. Ask him. Because, let's discuss what you mean by effective. If you mean by making it where people don't accidentally connect to you, yes. Yes, it's effective.
The SSID was never intended to be a secure part of the protocol, so you can turn it off in the beacons, but as soon as someone connects and the access point says, you're allowed to connect, there's the SSID. Kismet pulls it out automatically. Anything else could, I'd just automate it.
Yeah. Go to 802.11ninja.net/airjack. Grab the stuff. There's still one tool that's still in there. It's ESSID jack, which I wrote so people would stop thinking that was a security measure. It kicks somebody off using airjack. Thereby forcing them to reconnect, and I see that SSID. It's not a password.
My question was, you mentioned before that you guys use wireless networks at home. So, for the reason you don't use A, which is more secure because it's hardly enough passive, and on top of it, it has an entire left field also. Plus, there's a better throughput. Why would that be A?
Okay.
It has the same problems. It can still be monitored.
Sure. Its range generally is not nearly as long, and that's one good thing from that perspective, but some perspectives that's bad. The increased WEP links doesn't impress me. WEP is dead. WEP is totally broken. It's starting to smell. Like, just let it go. You can make a bajillion bit key. I don't care. Okay, WEP is done. But as far as I do use A, I use G, but primarily I mostly use B because B or G because it's backwards compatible. It's a major deal. Yeah. Because he wants to get free porn on my network.
Mike Kershaw and I have been trying to get in touch with manufacturers to talk about flaws in firmware for over 6 months. We contacted every person we knew at all these companies to talk about, your firmware sucks, and it's easily exploitable, and there are a lot of bugs, and we didn't talk about it today, but, I mean, they don't want to hear it from the security industry, you know, and it's just that we're nice guys, so we don't just post it on bug track, but...
I have talked to some of them through my work. If it were just me, they would never listen to me. Only through my work, without much gain from it. But well, you got me confused with somebody else who cracks it. So I think his question is something to the effect of what are we going to do when cell phone companies come out using SIM authentication, is it?
There's a point of rental for
SIM cards.
It's used for wireless.
Okay. I see. He said a lot, so that's it for me to paraphrase. He's saying about the SIM. I don't really. You talk to this man. I don't really mean to. It's just you said a very lot there. He's talking about using SIM cards. Some cellular companies using SIM cards to authenticate 802.11 new devices, and whether or not I think this is a good idea or it's a single point of failure. I think it's probably a really bad idea, just because they shouldn't. Yeah. Right. Wrap up or? Okay. We still have three things to give away then.
Yeah. So
let's do three more. Three questions.
Does everybody know what's up here?
Oh, really?
Somebody's got to
take. Yeah. Somebody take swag first off, and then.
This is a cellular modem, okay? So you can like hack people from anywhere. Not like you can't do it already with wireless, but you know. What? This book?
Yes.
If we offer you swag, please come up and get it.
If we didn't offer you swag and you can beat them up here, come and get it.
Oh, man.
Sorry, yeah? Guys. That's it for the swag.
Oh,
sorry, guys.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, use strong authentication. Strong means PKI. Keep your known host file, current and never just click yes. Strong authentication, it can be done right. You have a whole can of worms though, because I'm on your physical network. If I can't get in through your SSH, I now have physical access to your machine and I can just try and hack you dead on and then steal your SSH key. So.
Do we have time for any more? You want to wrap it up? Or did you get your thing going for the...
Yeah, why don't we just wrap it up
first? Does he have time for his demo?
Yeah,
or anybody wants to stick around?
Yeah.
I think Anton wants to stick around. If anybody wants to stick around, he got it going to demo it. And then...
Yeah. Abaddon, thank you very much. All right. We know everybody wants to go out and get blitzed. The show doesn't start till 11 o'clock tomorrow, but... Anton's going to spend some time doing his demonstrations for Web Wedgie, and then we'll take some more questions until we need to go drinking. So
If you want to stick around for questions after the demo, please do, but don't feel bad about leaving to go get hammered. Thank you.